This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Within weeks of the ratification of the treaty by Dáil Éireann, exactly a century ago, on the 21st of January 1922, an Irish Race Congress assembled in Paris, representing Irish organisations from 22 countries worldwide. Inevitably, the treaty split overshadowed its proceedings. Did global Irish experiences moderate or radicalise expectations of Irish independence? What legacy did Irish sovereignty bequeath to the historical memory of the Irish diaspora? So to answer these and other questions, I'm joined by Dara Gannon, who lectures in Irish studies at UCD and is also commissioning editor of The Split, From Treaty to Civil War, 1921 to 23, the fourth of History Ireland's special supplements tracking the decade of centenaries. We're joined by Donal McCracken, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, David Brundage, Professor of History at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and finally, Anne-Marie O'Brien, Lecturer in Maynooth University's Department of History. And this Hedge School is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. And of course, I have to remark that we're going truly global with this Hedge School, our first from three continents, which is a milestone for us and appropriate for this particular discussion. Dara Gannon, can I go to you first? Was the Race Congress a one-off, or were there previous ones? Were there any antecedents?
Well, Tommy, while the global Irish Race Congress in Paris in January of 1922 will get enormous commemorative attention, I think it is important to recognise that this idea of an Irish Race Convention was very transnational and was very important politically and strategically during the Irish Revolutionary period. We have race conventions from 1919 to 1922, for example, in Philadelphia, in Melbourne and Buenos Aires. And what's interesting about those conventions is, first of all, they suggest inherently a global Irish network, that those events were almost linked in organizational terms. And that was very much as part of the propaganda exercise to demonstrate the strength and solidarity of the Irish diaspora. But also, secondly, it is important to recognize that they really had a very strong American genesis. I mean, there were three Irish race conventions in the United States during this revolutionary period. In New York in March of 1916, again in New York in May of 1918, and finally in Philadelphia of February of 1919. And what I think is quite interesting in this regard is actually they were used inherently in Irish American terms in the United States for the purpose in 1916 to create unity around the idea of the Irish Republic after the split caused by John Redmond's support of the First World War. And then in 1919 in Philadelphia, they're very much evoking this idea of an Irish race and the success of the Irish race. And they mentioned, for example, the delegates who are in attendance, congressmen. We have Cardinal Gimmons, Justice Cardigan, and Congressman Gallagher. So I think it's quite interesting that there's an Irish-American influence, but there's also a global influence as well. I think David would be very interesting to hear what he has to say regarding the American politics behind the Irish Race Convention.
Actually, David, just before you come in here, can I just tease out this question of the term race here, right? Because that's, you know, it's a term that wouldn't be used today, right? Because there's no scientific for this concept of race insofar as, you know, there's one human race, right? And if you, Donal, would agree with me on that. That's something we might come back to, Dara, right? Because you just don't, just hold that thought, because this question of, you know, who or what were the Irish crops up in our discussion. But I just want to put a marker down on that question. Sorry, David, sorry for interrupting you. If you just want to talk to us. Yeah.
It's a great point, Tommy, and we should come back to it. Yeah. You know, the first and the third US conventions are in some ways are the most interesting. The first gives birth to this new organization, the Friends of Irish Freedom, which, you know, by 1919 has some 300,000 members. It's really a force to be taken seriously on the American scene. The third Irish convention, race convention in Philadelphia, really marks the kind of effort of Irish Americans to really have a global stage, to find a global stage. And they appoint a group, a three-person group at this convention called the American Commission on Irish Independence, led by a former Wilson administration figure named Frank Walsh, who go directly to the Paris Peace Conference and attempt to push the idea of self-determination for Ireland at the peace conference. So it's a very important convention. And as Dara said, it indicated the diversity of supporters for Irish nationalism, Irish republicanism by this point in time, from priests to congresspeople to politicians at the local level, to a strong labor dimension as well.
Now, Anne-Marie, can I bring you in? And because Dara's mentioned a race convention in Buenos Aires and, you know, Argentina. And I think for many of our listeners, you know, they wouldn't necessarily think of Argentina as part of this Irish diaspora. So just before you talk about the race convention itself, just give us a kind of a pen picture of the Irish in Argentina.
Sure, Tommy. So the Irish in Argentina really dates back to the 19th century. There was a lot of Irish emigration, particularly between the period of 1830 to 1880. Argentina was had the largest Irish community of any country in South America. Chile, for example, only had about 300 Irish in the 1920s, just to give you some kind of flavour of how important Argentina was. So I think people will be surprised that there was an Irish race convention in Buenos Aires. But when you think of, you know, between 30,000 and 45,000 Irish emigrants, it becomes that little bit less surprising. And just a different kind of flavor for Latin America in particular. You also have to remember that Roger Casement was the British consul in Brazil from 1906, and he traveled throughout South America. And he said of Argentina, there are many more Irishmen here, most of them really quite rich. They are by far the most successful out of all the immigrants in this wonderful country. So that's really the background to the Irish in Argentina.
Anne-Marie, how had they enriched themselves? What sort of businesses were they in?
Yeah, so they were viewed as being part of the landed class. They were viewed as wealthy. Many made their wealth in Argentina from sheep farming. And even in Chile, where there was only about 300 people of Irish extraction, the diplomat Frank Egan, he found that the Irish in Chile were in influential positions, and some of them in direct contact with the president and American legation. So that really shows you that they had actually made successes of themselves in South America.
So would I be right in assuming then that Argentina wouldn't have the same, say, diversity that David mentioned in relation to the United States, that, you know, it's of a particular class and a wealthy landed class at that?
Absolutely, yeah. There was very little diversity. There was a faction where the Irish Argentinian community had kind of split into two groups, and that made propaganda particularly difficult for the diplomats in Argentina. But yes, they were certainly of the same class, landed class.
And in terms of Irish origin, they're from the same place, aren't they? They're all kind of Westmead, Longford, that sort of area, as I understand it. They're from, you know, yep. They're North Midlands. No, I remember a few years ago, there was a radio documentary about the Irish in Argentina. And the chap on, you know, several generations removed, and he had hardly any English. He'd broken English. But his broken English was in this really thick Westmead accent. It was the most peculiar sensation listening to this guy. Now, moving back, Dara, to the Paris Race Congress. By the way, what's the difference between a congress and a convention? Or should we waste any time in that one? Or are they more or less the same thing, Dara?
That's a very good question, Tommy.
I've stumbled upon a good question. Good.
I'll come back to you on your next head school on that one.
Right. Anyway, just Derek, just if you want to pick up on the Paris Congress.
Well, as we said earlier, there were a number of congresses during the revolutionary period, and the Irish Race Congress in Paris is perhaps the most significant because it brings those ostensibly national Irish race conventions, and this might answer your question, to a transnational congress. And this took place in January of 1922. But the idea originated in South Africa with the Irish Republican Association of South Africa. And they pitched a very much a diaspora-led initiative, unlike the DFA-led initiative, which ostensibly took place. And I think Donal could speak probably to the importance of the South African initiative in relation to the Irish Race Congress in Paris.
Yeah, Don, just before you answer that question, just give us a pen picture of the Irish in South Africa. Of course, the most well-known intervention, of course, was Major John McBride during the Boer War. I think most of our listeners would have heard of that. Just give us a picture.
Well, it's interesting because it's very different from the Argentinian picture. The settlement is about 240 years old. South Africa as a country only exists from 1910, but there were colonies and statelets that existed and where the Irish were never great in numbers because, of course, they were part of the white population, but they were English speaking, but they were a minority of a minority of a minority. And their position in those societies was very different. They weren't particularly wealthy. Their numbers were relatively small. By 1921, there were only 12,000 first generation. Now, if you have a multiplier of about three, that takes it up to about 40,000 so-called ethnic Irish in the whole of the subcontinent. So you have this tiny little population, and yet its impact has been so tremendous. And that is partly because of settlement. And it wasn't the sort of settlement that the famine produced. These were young men. Arthur Griffith, when he came out to South Africa, said it was more like going on a sojourn than it was emigrating. There are no romantic stories about Ireland left in Africa. There are no songs about leprechauns on the high veldt and other such stuff that you get elsewhere. There were young men working on the mines, working in the railways, working on the mounted police forces because they wanted farmers who could ride and shoot, and of course the missionaries. Now, King Cetshwayo of the Zulus famously said, first the missionary, then the trader, and finally the red soldier. And the Irish were part and parcel of all three of those categories that came to subjugate the subcontinent, in fact, the whole continent in the very end. But the missionary endeavour, and there were, I suppose, it depends when you're looking at it, about 12 orders down here, and there were also further north, of course, north of the Limpopo River, were very, very important because in the end, of course, they were the last line of defense, as it were, for the black population, for the indigenous population. And the work that they did in education and in health in particular was quite legendary. When in my classes, if I get a young person from a mission school, and they hear that I'm Irish, then you're immediately elevated above one's college. Well,
as I understand it, Donal, I mean, I'm a product of Templo College, a Holy Ghost Father School, or the Spiritans, as they're now called, right? And many of my teachers had been in Nigeria, in Biafra, and of course they had to leave Biafra when that regime collapsed, but it's clear that many of them didn't regard themselves as white, if you get my meaning. Do you know what I mean? That they identified totally with the indigenous population.
Point. That's the point. They did identify with the local indigenous population. And because of that, I have argued, and the older I get, the more I'm convinced that I'm right about this, that you cannot actually lump the missionaries in with the Irish. They are a separate entity. They sometimes lived amongst the Irish population. They were of them, and yet they weren't of them, because of this affinity. I'm not saying that the Irish were part and parcel of the white dispensation, the white regime. Well, some were, and there were famous colonial Irish people, some good, some bad, some ugly. But most of them were out just to make a living. And of course, you mentioned John McBride. There were two Irish commandos, about 500 lads were fighting on the side of the Afrikaners. Which, of course, is very ironic, because the Afrikaners had their own attitude towards the Church of Rome, and yet the Irish were supporting them, the dislike of the traditional enemy being so great. But the missionaries appealed to the local population, and it's contradictory, though, because the argument that missionaries undermined African traditional society is partly true. You cannot get away from that fact. And you read Bishop Raymond Griffith's diary, the first bishop of the Cape in the 1830s, where he goes round the eastern province and breaking up these relationships where Irishmen are living with African or women of mixed race. So it's not a simple story, but then of course South Africa generally isn't a simple story.
Now, Donald, just while we're on this, right, I mean, speaking of the indigenous population, the African National Congress was established, what, 1912, I think, was it? Yes. So they already, any organizational links or did they, were they on a different planet in practical terms?
Of the ordinary Irish society?
No, I'm just saying, was that any awareness or recognition of organizations like the ANC, such as it was at that stage?
Minimal.
Okay,
In fact, and we'll come on to this later on, the drift was towards aligning with Herzog's nationalists against Smuts and the South African Party, but I'll deal with that.
Okay. Let's come back to that. Now, Derek, going back to you, the South Africans came up with this idea, and then the ball was whipped off their toe by the Dáil Department of Foreign Affairs. If you just take up the story from there, like who then was involved from there on in?
Yes, well, as Donald has alluded to, the South African influence was very important in initiating this idea. And it was really supposed to be a great meeting of the Irish diaspora, basically a precursor to modern day, the Global Ireland brand. And I think it is important to use that term in terms of the Irish Race Convention, that it is an element of brand nationalism, you know, to use the term Irish Race Convention or Irish Race Congress. It gives it an impact greater than the sum of its parts, really. And so while this was pitched in March 1921 by the Irish Republican Association of South Africa and supported by Irish nationalists in London, most notably Art O'Brien, by the summer it essentially had been taken over by the DFA, and De Valera had returned from the United States at this stage and was very keen to use this idea, as I mentioned earlier, of an Irish Race Convention to basically evoke the global influence and power of the Irish race. And it can be seen something of a counterweight to the global impact of the British Empire. So that the Irish, when it came to political negotiation during the summer of 1921, that they could use this idea of an Irish Race Congress to offset the potential impact of the Empire. Now, it's quite interesting, in fact, who De Valera appointed as the main organizer, and that was the Canadian-born Catherine Hughes. She actually described herself as a once upon a time Canadian, which is quite self-epithet. But Catherine Hughes had been one of the keen organisers around the world of Irish nationalist organisations. She'd set up the Irish Self-Determination League for Canada and Newfoundland. She had accompanied De Valera on his tour of the Deep South in the United States. And she'd also, most remarkably, organized the Irish Self-Determination League in Australia and New Zealand during a period in 1921 when Archbishop Mannix, the most notable figure of Irish Australia, was touring the world. So she becomes this kind of representative for the Dáil in Paris from September of 1921. But it's really De Valera's idea at this point.
Derek, can I just come in there on the Catherine Hughes, right? And the names of these organizations, right? The Self-Determination for Ireland League, no mention of a republic, whereas I noticed that some of the American organizations are explicitly have the word republic and South Africa indeed in their titles. What's the significance of that, or is there any?
That's a very important point, I think, you've raised, Tommy, in relation to the fact that these were organizations, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, which were within the British Empire. And in many ways, the idea of a republic was not good PR for Irish nationalism in those dominions. Irish nationalism was not trusted within mainstream opinion in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, certainly since the 1916 rising. And it's quite interesting to note in the autumn of 1919, they have an Irish race convention in Melbourne, which is convened by Mannix. And ostensibly, it's actually to respond to the Irish Race Convention, which is held in Philadelphia, to give this idea of a global Ireland brand and a global Irish network. But internally in those debates, and I've looked at the sources in Melbourne and the archives, the discussions really are based on, we need to create an organization which represents the new Sinn Féin idea of self-determination, but we can't use the term Sinn Féin or republic. So hence the term Irish Self-Determination League is used in Australia, in New Zealand, and Canada as well.
Isn't it interesting, though, Dara, that it foreshadows the treaty split in a way, this, you know, that's precisely, you know, the where the thing cleaved, you know, along this question, you know, whether it be self-determination in a vague way or an explicit republic.
I think that's really important to bear in mind, especially because when we talk about the Irish Race Congress in Paris in January of 1922, it's often overshadowed by the earlier treaty debates, of course, which last almost a month, whereas it's just 1 week in Paris. But some of these discussions which are happening in Paris speak to the importance of what you just mentioned, that, you know, there are politics, Irish nationalist politics are very different in different countries around the world. You can't just, you know, copy and paste the politics of, you know, the Irish Republic to Irish diaspora organizations. And I know, for example, I mean, we saw that in the United States, which David Brundage might want to speak to, the fact that De Valera ostensibly tried to bring his version of Irish nationalism to America to very divisive effect.
David, yeah. you want to come in on that, David? Yeah?
Sure, I'll jump in here. Yeah, I mean, we talked about already the this organization, the Friends of Irish Freedom, which grew out of that first Irish Race Convention in 1916. But during, you may have talked about this in an earlier head school, but during De Valera's tour of the United States in 1919-1920, a major break in the movement between that organization and its leaders, most importantly, the old Fenian John Devoy, and a Tammany figure by the name of Judge Cahalan, and De Valera and his supporters. Out of that break comes a new organization, the American Association for the Recognition of the Irish Republic, and of the Irish Republic. So there's that reference to republicanism. But by the time you get to the Paris Congress, you know, we've got really a broken American movement, still large, still. You know, with money and power, but also really divided between two separate poles. I think it's really interesting. Neither of those two organizations send representatives to the Paris Congress.
Tell you what, let's hold that one, because before we discuss who wasn't there, if I go back to you, Dara, who was there? I mean, there are 22 countries represented. Would it be possible just to lash through the list of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really remarkable. And again, think about the difficulties of 100 years ago, notwithstanding the difficulties in revolutionary Ireland, but, you know, traveling the world was a very different experience.
That was my next question. How are they paying for all of this? But we'll come back to that in a second. So just go through the list there, maybe, to give us an idea of this thing.
Well, there are delegates from Australia, New Zealand, Great Britain, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Mexico, Belgium, France, Spain, Italy, and I should add one representative from Java, which is a bit of an outlier. And of course, there were Irish representatives, and these are the main figures, really, that have just emerged from the treaty debates, the divisive treaty debates. De Valera is present, Owen McNeill on the pro-treaty side, Mary McSweeney, Countess Markovic. So, you know, this is the great and good of Irish nationalism for the most part. And I mean, even in terms of traveling, some of the Australian delegates make the point that they've taken 3 weeks to get there. So can you imagine? They've left before the treaty has even been signed.
And presumably this must have cost them a fortune, you know, to hang out in Paris for a week, you know, having travelled from the far side of the globe, you know, would take a few bob.
Yeah, it cost, absolutely.
It cost Benjamin Farrington, the South African delegate, £300.
Well, that's a lot of money in those days, you know, yeah. Now, let's go back to David's point, because this is kind of like reminds me of, you know, why wasn't De Valera, you know, negotiating the treaty in London? Why were there no US delegates at this particular Congress, David?
So I think, the American Association for the Recognition of the Irish Republic, that's by then the larger organization, they just make a statement that you know, they think the Paris Congress will be overshadowed by the treaty debate. They mainly, although they're divided, they in the end very much end up on the anti-treaty side. Du Bois organization, the Friends of Irish Freedom, they're a little bit more complicated because they end up taking a pro-treaty stance. I don't know what the answer for their absence is. I do have a guess that it has to do, Michael Drury wrote a really excellent book on the Friends a number of years ago, argued that really, although they're an example of diasporic nationalism, they really had such an inward, almost American first point of view that led to part of the conflict with De Valera back in 1920. I'm just going to guess that made them very unreceptive to the very idea of the global Irish that we're talking about right now.
Anne-Marie, can I move on to you then? What effect did you know this the treaty split then have on the Irish diaspora and the network in South America?
So the majority of the Irish community in South America were in support of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. So just to give you an example, the leaders of the Chilean Irish community said or wrote that it was their bounden duty to abide by whatever decision our leaders at home may think it advisable to come to, which really is, I kind of read it as we have no idea of what's going on. So we're going to go with the flow here. And that was one of the problems in South America, was that they were so far removed from what was actually happening in Ireland that they didn't really have an idea of what was happening. Argentina, though, was a little bit different. They weren't, the majority of the community there were not in support of the Irish Treaty. The most important organisation, I think, for the Irish-Argentinian community was the Argentine Committee for the Liberty of Ireland. And you'll note again that there's no republic in that name also. So they were really the signing of the treaty centered in Argentina around the bond drive and how the bond drive could no longer continue because the republic was now in what they viewed as debt. They would not give money to a free state. And just to kind of give you a context, Lawrence Ganell had been there for a couple of months. He was just really starting to get the bond drive up and running in November, December of 1921, when the news came that the Anglo-Irish Treaty had been signed.
Which way did he go on the treaty, Anne-Marie?
Staunchly anti-treaty, and his wife Alice was also anti-treaty, and she wrote in her Bureau of Military History, it was a diary actually, but it's in the witness statements, that when the news came that the Anglo-Irish Treaty had been signed, that perhaps Lawrence should remove himself from the Irish public life, and he certainly should not take the oath of allegiance to the king.
But didn't he missed the treaty vote, didn't he? Because he was still in Argentina.
Yes, absolutely. He was still in Argentina. He remained there until I think it was June 1922 when he returned to Ireland.
Was that a convenient sojourn for him, you know, to avoid the, you know, the stuff back at the divisiveness back home?
I don't think so. But through reading the diaries of Alice and Lawrence Ganell, it seems to me that they really didn't know what was going on. You know, so for example, when they set sail for Argentina. It turns out that this was July of 1921 and a truce had occurred. And it's written in the diaries. Had we known that a truce had occurred, we would have been sailing for home, not South America. So there is a real difficulty in terms of communication between Dublin and Argentina. And I think it was a surprise when news came that the Anglo-Irish Treaty had been signed.
Now, Dara, I want to just go back to this question of definitions, right, which I raised earlier, the Irish race, right? Just talk to us a bit about, I mean, was this discussed, the definition of who are the Irish, like who are part of this global entity, if it is a global entity? I mean, was there any discussion of that?
The issue of race was certainly brought to the fore in the debates. I mean, it's 1 week of day-long discussions, in Paris. I mean, I should say it wasn't all deep-level high politics. I mean, they were at the Hotel Continental on Rue de la Paix, one of the most prestigious and wealthy streets in Paris. Just to give you some context for your listeners, the Rue de la Paix, in which they were based, is the most expensive street on the game of Monopoly, for the French version of Monopoly. Okay, so they were sitting in very kind of luxurious conditions and so on. But some of the debates were very interesting because, unlike the debates of surrounding the treaty several weeks earlier, which were debates over the constitutional status of Ireland, here we have debates and discussions over what does it mean to be Irish, issues over citizenship, and as you mentioned, Tommy, most pertinently perhaps the issue of race, because the issue of race is inherent in the idea of the Irish Race Convention, but it never really had been defined suitably by Irish nationalists at those events. And we do have a kind of real tension here within the Irish Race Congress in Paris, when there's a degree of support, for example, for limiting any future organization to those of Irish birth or descent. We have one representative from America who I think came over on his own, Father Shanley, and he said to the remaining members of the Congress, we have got every race in the world in the AARIR. We've got Chinese, Jews, Turks, Armenians, and Russians. And I want people to bear in mind that some of the people of those races were our best friends. And that's a direct quote. So there are basically diverging views of what constitutes Irishness, what constitutes race, from different parts of the Congress. And really what's brought out, and it speaks to what David's suggesting earlier as well, is the diversity of Irishness and the diversity of Irish nationalism and the diversity of the meaning of the Irish race.
David, maybe if we go to you on that one, is this a perennial question in Irish American organizations?
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, Tommy, when we think of race in the United States, early 20th century and today, we often think of color. We think of blacks and whites, and the Irish are obviously white, and were defined so by naturalization law going back to the 1790s. But two points, I guess, I'd want to make that the word race, as Dara said, meant something different in the early 20th century. It did. I mean, I kind of think of it as another way of saying ethnic identity or nationality. There's that kind of a little bit lack of clarity with the word race. But in terms of the Father Shanley's quote, both the United States and support for Irish republicanism were extremely multiracial or multicultural, multi-ethnic in the era of the Irish Revolution. This is, to me, one of the most fascinating points, about this moment in Irish American history. So, for instance, Marcus Garvey, leader of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, a Black nationalist organization, is a critically important supporter of the Irish Revolution. And that's just one example. We have Indians and Poles and others giving really full-throated support to the Irish cause. So this is a really distinctive moment in, I'd say, the global history of the Irish.
Just going back to the question of race and color. I mean, did the Irish tend to hunt with the hares and run with the hounds? I mean, I'm thinking of De Valera when he was addressing a meeting in Alabama on his tour. and he referred to Ireland as the only, you know, white nation still in bondage, you know, which very much obviously tailored for his audience.
And Dylan said exactly the same thing when he was in New Zealand in the 1890s. So there was that concept that the Irish were being unfairly treated, that they were being treated like a black population would be.
I mean, this crops up in Arthur Griffith's The Resurrection of Hungary, you know, where he's extolling the virtues of a Hungarian nationalism, but he's rather disparaging about the Romanians and the Slovaks and the various other subject peoples who are, you know, under Hungarian domination. But maybe that's a discussion for another day. Dara, you alluded to this, right? That they were in the Shrewsbury Road of Paris, right? So, did they have any crack, right? I mean, there's a photograph we used in the split supplement, and it'll be posted along with this podcast of Dev and Mary McSweeney and several others sitting down, and there's several bottles of champagne, which look empty, actually, you know, on the table, and they're all smiling. And I have to say, I always go out of my way to print pictures of De Valera smiling. What was it like?
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make again, Tommy. Empty champagne bottles, you know. So there evidently was an element of joie de vivre associated with the Congress. And there could be an element as well of, you know, despite the fact that there were tensions, just kind of a release after the fraught nature of the treaty debates. If you look at the reports of the last day of the Anglo-Irish treaty debates in Dublin, De Valera breaks down emotionally. That's what's recorded in the newspapers. And so there's an element of, you know, getting away from the worst of the divisions, although there were divisions in Paris nonetheless. So I think it's fascinating to look at this as a cultural exhibition, which, you know, there were politics discussed, but it was also really what I would characterize it as, the great exhibition of Irish nationalism. And I mean, for one thing, the proceedings were opened on the 21st of January with a premiere of an Irish gallery of 300 works of sculpture, painting and decorative arts at the world-famous Galerie Barbanzage. There was an organized tour of the Irish College Seminary in the Latin Quarter. They visited the Pantheon, for example. And you have to bear in mind, I suppose, that this is the age in 1921, 1922, in the Latin Quarter of Hemingway and Gertrude Stein and Pablo Picasso. I mean, if any of you have watched Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, you'll know exactly what the Latin Quarter looks like and feels like in 1922. So it's fascinating to think, in those kind of cultural terms, that De Valera and Markievicz may well have been rubbing shoulders with Hemingway and Stein and Picasso as well. And so it's a fascinating kind of representation. There are lectures, W.B. Yeats, Jack Yeats, Douglas Hyde all give lectures. So it's a great meeting of Irish nationalists, and it's intended, certainly after the treaty, to kind of give the best representation of global Ireland, as it was known today, you know, to international audiences. But it is important to remember that the idea, going back to this point, the idea of the Global Irish Congress, born in South Africa, as Donal has alluded to, really was to, you know, offset the kind of the political impact or effect of the British Empire, and especially during the treaty negotiations. And so many of the diaspora leaders, including representatives from South Africa, for example, mentioned this during the negotiations, that they feel disappointed that they've travelled so far not to be able to have a say in the shape of Irish independence and not to be able to affect the ongoing treaty negotiations.
I think it's important to remember that the Irish Republican Association was a Sinn Féin organisation, unashamedly. It was very new. It was only founded in November 1920, basically because of a group of intellectuals who came together, like Benjamin Farrington and Alfred O'Flaherty, an Oxford Sanskrit gold medalist, Dr. Forsyth, who was described as a pronounced negrophile, and Ella Nicholson, a prominent Irish woman in Cape Town. She actually dies when P.J. Little is visiting South Africa as the envoy a few months later. They were very disappointed. They felt that it had been hijacked. They wanted to keep the Dáil cabinet out of not of the event, but of organizing the event, because they saw it essentially as a league of what was called hyphenated Irishmen, Irish South Africans, Irish Argentinians, Irish Americans, Irish Australians, what have you, and with a supranational organization of Irish expat bodies. With a headquarters in Geneva or at The Hague. You know, they were thinking big, these lads. And of course, as you quite rightly said, Daryl and Tommy, the thing was hijacked by Foreign Affairs. And then during the conference itself, Farrington was the only one they could afford. The South Africans gave £250 for the organization, towards the organization of the conference, and then another £300 for Farrington to go over. And he was secretary of the conference. Not that I think he was particularly efficient. He seems to have spent his time running around collecting autographs from people. But he did put forward a resolution claiming, asking that there be a memorial. Established in Ireland, a working memorial, like an institution of some sort, for the Irish diaspora, and it was shot down on the grounds that the money would have to be given to the government in Dublin, and that would be for the pro-treatyites. And Farrington and co were utterly shocked by that. They were kept out of the executive, they claimed. At the elections, because it was said, you know, it was too far to go. You know, it was 2 weeks on a ship from Cape Town. It was three and a half weeks on a ship, at least from Australia, even going through the Suez Canal. And because of that, they basically it ceased to be anything that they were really interested in. And Farrington himself said that they may as well, after the first meeting, they may as well have divided and had two separate congresses for all the good it was doing.
Well, that brings up the question, like, was it the intention that there would be more congresses? I mean, was this meant to be the first of a series? Dara, any views on that?
Yeah, the intention was that this would be a recurring event that this would, again, I mean, initially that it was supposed to kind of represent the best of Irish political representations in terms of global Ireland, but certainly by early 1922, the writing was on the wall after the treaty split that this would probably become a global cultural movement. And the irony is, and I've written about this previously, is that the organization that they set up to ostensibly create sustain this discussion, this global Irish discussion, was called Fine Gael. Family of the Gael, and yet that Fine Gael has been lost in the annals of history somewhat, and yet the term Fine Gael is remembered in terms of the pro-treaty, the inheritors of the pro-treaty side. So I think it's quite an interesting take on how the Irish diaspora kind of fade from the scene post-1922 and post-independence.
Now, I think, can I just come in there, just because, just before I lose the thought, they were encouraged. The diaspora had been encouraged by the provisional government. Remember that they sent the emissaries out, and we have Patrick J. Little coming to South Africa and Colonel Thomas Moore coming at the same time but separately to South Africa, and then going on to the Argentine. After that, there was this definite feeling that the diaspora could help them. And then, as I say, the Congress comes and they feel betrayed.
Anne-Marie, can I just go to you before we move on? I mean, were there any particular contributions made by the Argentinian or the South American delegates?
Yeah, so I think Donal has already alluded to this, but Farrington really became the spokesperson for the overseas delegates. So as Dara already mentioned, there was delegates from Argentina, Brazil, Chile and Mexico. And just as an aside, PJ Little actually attended the Congress as part of the delegation of the Brazilian delegation. So their contribution at the actual Congress was fairly limited. I think the most substantial contribution was made by the Argentine delegate, Mr. Bowen, and he was asked by Harry Boland to propose Eamon de Valera as the president of what would become Fine Gael, which is what Dara has been just speaking about. And Barron saw this suggestion as undesirable, and he actually proposed the Duke of Tetuan as president, and that Arthur Griffith and Eamon de Valera should be vice presidents of the executive. Of course, de Valera kind of brushed this aside, and that the Duke would be not be able to attend, and the onus was the new thing that was brought in was that anyone on the executive should be within 24 hours of Dublin in terms of travelling. So when that was proposed, then Bowen suggested that President Griffith, Arthur Griffith, should be president of the Fine Gael. And again, this was brushed aside by de Valera because President Griffith had not consented to his name going forward. And that was really the only substantial contribution that was really made by the Argentine delegate. I couldn't find any kind of evidence that Brazil, Chile or Mexico made any substantial interventions. As I said, Farrington really kind of led the cause for the overseas delegates.
Now, Dara, sorry, come back to you. I mean, did any definite proposals come out of this, you know?
So I think that's kind of where we are really at the end of the Congress. They've missed the boat, so to speak, on influencing any decision over the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And it devolves into kind of a series of proposals regarding Ireland's cultural future and how the Irish diaspora ostensibly can contribute to that. And it's quite interesting, actually, in terms of where we are today to see how many of those proposals actually came to fruition. De Valera actually proposes that Irish studies chairs at universities around the world should be established. I think we can all agree on that. There's also proposals, for example, for a dictionary of Irish biography, which should include representatives of the Irish diaspora, which again, great foresight on the part of the Irish.
Took a while, though. That one took a while, but
got there in the end. And what's also quite interesting is actually there are differences going back to these tensions between different countries in terms of, you know, how education should be supported. Because as you mentioned, Tommy, there's a limited budget here, and especially when it comes to the provisional government, there's, you know, a limited budget put aside ostensibly for the new Fine Gael movement, but there's underlying tensions, class tensions at that, in terms of how the Irish diaspora should be supported in terms of education. So, for example, you've got the vice rector of the Irish College in Rome, Monsignor Michael Curran, emphasizing that there needs to be greater attention to higher education, so supports for Irish universities in Europe, etc. He argues you must have higher Irish learning because you must have professors to teach children. And in many ways, that kind of represents, I think, the kind of 16th and 17th century tradition of Irish learning in continental Europe. Whereas if you contrast that, the Australian delegate from Sydney makes the point that actually you must have access to education from below, and says that basically there should be kind of, Irish language classes, in every city rather than in universities. So I think even in education, there are diverging views of what the future should look like for the Irish diaspora.
Ava, can I come to you in the light of these difficulties, right? Where the American organization, the Irish American organizations who didn't attend, but they kind of saying, well, we told you so.
Yeah, I was actually doing a little bit of, looking around in the Irish press to just see what kind of coverage there was of the Congress. And it was quite minimal. The debate over the treaty, and then, of course, we're already on a path that's going to lead to civil war. Those were much more pressing issues for the Irish in America. So I just have to say that I don't think that the impact of the Irish race Congress itself was that great on the United States.
Well, actually, this brings me on then to my final concluding question here. I mean, we can all chip in on this one. Was it a success or a failure? I mean, before we answer that, how would you measure whether it's a success or a failure? Dara?
I think it was a success in terms of the organizational feats led by Catherine Hughes, that once upon a time Canadian, cannot be, you know, overstated. To bring people from around the world, Irish nationalists around the world, to converge in Paris really represented the kind of the ultimate success of this idea of an Irish race convention. And ostensibly, it potentially had the power to, you know, affect the political negotiations in London had they continued. But at the same time, I think it has to be marked down as a failure in the history books because, as I alluded to earlier, this great global Irish organization which emerged from the Congress, Fine Gael, has been completely overshadowed, indeed written out of the Irish history books in place of Fine Gael, the inheritor of the pro-treaty party. So the Irish diaspora and the Irish Race Congress, to a certain extent, have been lost to history.
And, like, what impact did this have on the diaspora? Maybe Anne-Marie, I mean, did it have a dispiriting effect? I mean, in several hedge schools up to this, we've looked at the counter-state and the non-military side of the resistance against the British, and this international aspect was part of it. Did it all just disappear in a puff of smoke in the shadow of the treaty split?
Yeah, I don't think the Congress really had that much of an impact on the diaspora in Argentina. You know, the mission closed down shortly afterwards, in the middle of June 1922. You know, Gunnell and Bulfin returned to Ireland. Bulfin didn't, but he certainly wasn't working as a diplomat in Argentina. So really, I don't think it had that much of an effect on them. The Irish Argentinians saw themselves as Argentinians first. And that's a theme that runs throughout Irish diaspora in all of the countries that they are. They had really lost that connection to Ireland. It was a sentimental, emotional connection, but in terms of real value, I don't think it was there. The mission closed down, Gunnell returned to Ireland, and there was not much organisation after that.
I mean, I want to ask a cynical question here, and this reminds me of the gathering that we had back in 2013. Was the movement really just interested in their money, Donal? Any comment on that? Or am I being overly cynical? That was the role seen for the diaspora.
Certainly that was on the agenda. And when the emissaries toured, you know, in various parts of the world, one of two things. One was to give respectability to the concept of an independent Ireland. And the second pillar was to raise funds for it. And that was either directly raising funds or it was through something like the White Cross organization. So I think that's a good point you raise.
Dara, just a final question. I mean, are there any lessons for today, you know, for the Irish diaspora today, which you hear a lot about? I mean, you know, do you think is there any prospect we might have another similar Congress with different name, obviously?
Sure. I think it's quite interesting to note that, you know, the idea of global Ireland has not lost its way. There's certainly promoting that, and they're trying to expand their cultural and global imprint through the Irish diaspora, but also through transnational networks as well. You know, it's quite interesting that we look at the event 100 years ago. Basically, the Irish diaspora were not allowed to vote in the question of passing or rejecting the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which caused a lot of disappointment, disillusionment in the cause of Irish nationalism. And one of the issues which is certainly relevant in 2022, in fact, I believe the referendum is just around the corner in the next year or two, is whether the Irish diaspora should have a vote in Irish presidential elections. So it will be quite interesting to note that if that referendum takes place, how much the kind of the mood music has changed in relation to the Irish diaspora having a say on Irish nationalist politics.
Well, some of these questions haven't gone away at all. Listen, I think we'll wrap it up there. I mean, it's a most interesting discussion. I suspect new material for most of our listeners. Thank Dara Gannon, Donal McCracken, David Bundage, Anne-Marie O'Brien, And for our next Hedge School, we will be marking the centenary of the founding of An Garda Síochána, or the Civic Guard, which will be posted on the 25th of February. I hope you can join us for that, listeners. Thank you very much.